Well, we've said that the book of Hebrews is written to a group of people beaten down with troubles and suffering to the point that they were ready to give up. And so at every point in this book, the author is teaching us, too, how to deal with our own troubles when they come our way. And I have to say, there's never been a time such as today when people really need help to face their troubles. I think we are a culture that really lacks a lot of resources because our understanding of reality in the world is not big enough. I'm going to expand on that later on in the sermon. And because of that, people really are struggling when things come at them in life, when trials, tribulations, they just don't know how to handle them. So we do need resources. And fortunately, today's text from Hebrews 12 offers us one or a number of them. And it tells us this. It tells us, or it teaches us first, that life is a race. Life is a race. The biblical author here uses the metaphor race, and I'm going to expand on that. Then he talks about why we should run this race. And then lastly, how to run this race. So life is a race. Why to run it and how to run it. First, life is a race. Now, what does that mean? Well, for the answer, we need to consider how the metaphor is used in this text, and it's particularly used in verses 1 to 4 and then verse 11. It says in one of the texts there, "Let us run the race set out for us." We really need to look at the Greek words here a little bit, so bear with me. The Greek word for race is the word from which we get the English word, and you wouldn't think of this, agony. English word, agony. And the race that the people who are running this race that it's referring to is you, are you and me. And therefore, the race refers to the sometimes agonizing struggle we face in life. Agonizing struggle we face in life. But this Greek word for race can also refer to a wrestling match or a contest. And reading a whole bunch of different commentators, they believe that this particular context is referring to a pentathlon, which was, by the way, the main event in the ancient Olympics, the Olympics of the day. And the pentathlon, as you probably know, included running, jumping, discus, javelin, and climax with an event that combined both wrestling and boxing. What is that event that happens today in a cage? Anybody?
UFC.
What? UFC. It's probably the same type of event. I think that's where they got it from, UFC. So this sounds pretty brutal, actually. Putting all this information together from this metaphor, race, we see that life is both a marathon and can be an agonizing struggle. Furthermore, it says in verse 11, discipline always seems painful rather than pleasant at the time, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. The word trained here is very important. It comes from the Greek word gymnasio, from which we get the word, you guessed it, gymnasium. And so this is saying when troubles or tragedies come your way, and a big one recently has been what happened to the Humboldt junior hockey team, Saskatchewan. When they come your way, you may feel like life is totally out of control. Like what's going to happen here? But just because it's not in your plan, it doesn't mean there is no plan, even in such tragedies. And if you're going to use this metaphor to shape your life, we also have to take into account it takes the form of an athletic training. It's a pentathlon. And if you understand that, we learn two things. First, suffering can be an opportunity to train you into the person God wants you to be. John Newton says, "Everything is necessary that he sends, but nothing can be necessary that he withholds." Now, I have to say, that's a hard saying. It may be an appropriate biblical perspective when you're actually in the midst of a horrible tragedy. But there's more than one perspective in the Bible on suffering. They are complementary, but they are different. Another one is where it says that God hates evil and suffering in this world, that he didn't create evil and suffering. And we, because of the way we've behaved, we sometimes bring evil and suffering into the world and upon ourselves. And God is going to incredible lengths to eventually end all evil and suffering. Now, there's an instance of this in the Bible. Just consider Jesus' response As he stood before the tomb of his friend Lazarus in the New Testament. He didn't say, well, all good things work together for those who love God. Instead, he bellowed, he wept, and interesting, he was angry. He was angry. God is angry that we suffer in this world. He doesn't want to see it happening. That is very important perspective on suffering. But you're not going to handle life unless you have this first one too. That suffering is an opportunity to exercise your virtues and make you into the person you're meant to be. Let's look at the physical realm for a moment. Doctors tell us that we're going to live a long, healthy life. We're not going to live a long, healthy life unless we're willing to exert ourselves and exercise. Now, what is exercise? Well, as I mentioned to the youth, it's taking a muscle or muscles and making it hard for it to do its job. Exercise opposes and puts stress on what your body does. And unless you do that to your muscles, your body is more likely to break down earlier in life. Likewise, your faith will never grow and be healthy unless it's exercised and tested at times. Your patience will never grow unless it's taxed. Your compassion will never grow unless it's tapped. Your courage will never grow unless it's challenged. In the midst of it, you don't see it. But afterwards, you do. So the first thing we learn from this athletic metaphor is that the difficulties of life can be opportunities to test and grow your faith and character. And frankly, without this stuff, you would be more of a shallow, immature person. But second, suffering is paradoxical. It's paradoxical in this way. When you are in the gym, clearly Grant's in the gym a lot more than I am. What do you want to do there? You actually want to get weak so you can get strong. Well, what do I mean by that? Well, let's say as you do bench presses, your muscles feel weaker and weaker, or as you do curls or whatever. But you want to feel weaker because that's how your muscles get bigger and stronger. Likewise, if you see life as a race, a pentathlon, that will exercise your character, you'll feel at times like your faith is diminishing, that your patience is waning, or your courage is getting weaker. But that doesn't mean they are. Could in fact becoming stronger and stronger. So life is a race, a pentathlon. Life is a struggle, but there's a plan, there's a positive outcome that can come out of it. One last thing before we move on to the next point. Do you know why this is so incredibly important? Expectations are everything. Half or more than half of the pain you or I experience when faced with difficulties aren't due to our troubles. They're due to the shock, confusion, and often, frankly, self-pity you're experiencing. Half the pain isn't from the event, but for your inability to process it. And it's largely because of expectations. George MacDonald, C.S. Lewis loved this writer, has a great saying. He says, every difficulty points to something more than our theory of life yet embraces. I mentioned theory of life before. In other words, if suffering comes into your life and you completely, let's say, fall apart, it's because your theory of life was inadequate and didn't embrace reality. Now, there's no denying, suffering is always going to hurt. But if you can enlarge your theory of life, there's more chance for you to become a person of greatness, a person who then is able to face the difficulties of things better. Now, what do I mean by theory of life? Well, it refers to what you're living for, basically. What is the energizing principle of your life? If, as the average Canadian thinks, you are living to maximize your happiness and comfort now, your suffering and troubles will destroy you. It'll destroy you. Why? Because suffering destroys your meaning of life, happiness and comfort. And once that's gone, you've got nothing left. Therefore, you've got to enlarge in your theory of life so you can handle suffering and troubles when they come your way. So first of all, life is a race. Second, why run this race? For the answer, we need to look at our way of thinking, our attitude, and our motivation. Verses 5 to 10 describe the mindset for running this race. But instead of carrying on with the race metaphor, the author here then changes metaphors. I know you're not supposed to, but he does. And he changes to the metaphor of God the Father, and particularly his care. And the reason he changes metaphors here is this. When you're in the middle of a tragedy or you're really suffering, it's not very comforting to think of God as your coach, right? Who somehow sends some exercise into your life. It does say in verse 6 that our Father disciplines us. But the Greek word for discipline is paideia, from which we get the word pediatrics. Interesting. And that's very important. A pediatrician, what is he or she concerned for? Primarily for the overall health and flourishing of a child. But the word discipline, unfortunately, doesn't get that across. When you and I think of the word discipline, what do we think of? We think of punishment, right? But God's discipline, or paideia, it's not about that. It's for our good, so we'll flourish as his children, as it says in verse 10. And the way to do that, and bear with me here because I want to do some qualifications, is sometimes with consequences. For instance, if my child lies, the worst thing I can do is not bring consequences into that child's life. So he will learn that if he lies all the time, no one's going to trust him, and he's not going to trust anyone else. And that's why we maybe send the child to his or her bedroom, right? Or whatever consequence. But as any parent knows, it's important not to overburden the child with consequences. The word paideia is not about retribution or payback. It refers to a kind of disciplinary suffering. And that means God is referred to here as a perfect parent who brings non-destructive, or at least maybe allows non-destructive suffering and pain into a child's life. But not one ounce more than the child absolutely needs to escape from the lying. It's only for the good. You see, God's parenting is not like ours. It says in verse 10, our fathers disciplined us for a short time as seemed best to them. In other words, human parenting is always a mixed bag. It's always a mixed bag. We try our best, but let's face it, our motivations are always mixed when our children disobey us. I know that's definitely for me. We give consequences to stop bad behavior, but we're also often full of emotion and mad at our kids because they disrespect us, and that sometimes gets in the way. So human parenting isn't clearly imperfect, but God's parenting is not. But it goes on to say in verse 10, God our Father disciplines us for our good in order that we may share in his holiness. The sufferings and difficulties that God allows to come into your life, into my life, is a way of getting his greatness and glory deep into your heart. And if you can't see that, as verse 7 says, you're not going to be able to face it head on and grow. Let me give you an example from the Bible. The story of Joseph is a great example. He was a spoiled youngest brother amongst a whole bunch of brothers. You know, the father really doted on him. And the other brothers hated him for it. And as you know, what happened? The brothers ended up almost killing him and selling him off to slave traders. And his life was pretty miserable for quite a while. He went off, he was in prison, he faced this and he faced that. But God used all that, and Joseph was open through his suffering to God, for God to change him and use him and turn him into a great, great man. He ended up saving his father, his brothers, and the whole people of Israel. Now, before I move on, I want to clarify what are God's consequences, because I'm sure you probably have difficulty with the notion of God giving consequences, and so do I. I can't avoid the text. That's what the text is saying. But I do have to say, I don't believe natural disasters like the Humboldt bus disaster. I don't think God purposely makes that happen here. I knew it's going to kill a bunch of you so you can learn some stuff. I don't think that's God's doing. I don't know why it happens. It just does. We live in a world where bad things like that happen. Okay? But on the other hand, when we sin, when we do activities, yeah, there are consequences to those sinful activities. God lets us go on our way. And we're going to trip along and we're going to face those things. And we're going to be in trouble. It's just like a child, you know, especially when they become a young adult. You tell them what to do, but you can't stop them from doing the wrong thing. And sometimes they have to trip along and hopefully they will learn. And hopefully we will learn from our Father. The point I'm really trying to make here is this: unless you see hardships of your life as paideia, as opportunities to mature and grow, what it inevitably will do to you is it will turn you into a bitter and miserable person. By the way, there are two alternative ways for handling suffering that are not a good idea. The one is stoicism, and the other one is the self-centeredness of our modern culture. In verse 5 it says, "You have forgotten the exhortation that addresses you as children. My child, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord or lose heart when you are punished by him." First, when it says, "Do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord," that's referring here, I believe, to Stoicism. The Greek word for regarding lightly means to despise. The Stoic says, when troubles come into my life, I'm not going to let it get to me, and I'm going to keep a stiff upper lip. But that's not what the Bible is talking about. Stoicism is not endurance. Okay? Let's go back to the example of a lying child. You say to your child, "Did you lie to me?" And the child admits it and says, "Yes." So you say, "You go to your room." But the child says, "Oh, but I was going to go to my friend's house." "No, you can't go to your friend's house. Go to your room." So the child goes to his room. Most times, or at least you hope, the child will kick and scream and promises he won't lie again. Good, right? But there's another kind of kid, and you may have experienced this, who will respond this way: "Well, I didn't want to go to my friend's house anyways." Right? There is a kind of kid who says to the parent, or at least is thinking, "You're the enemy. I'm not going to let you get to me." Instead of saying, "The lying is the enemy." That's why Stoicism is not the way. On the other hand, it says in verse 5, "Do not lose heart." Here it's referring to self-centered modern way. That's saying there is no good that can come out of this suffering or tragedy. There can't be a God who would let something like this happen. I don't believe in a God who would let evil and suffering happen. And because I can't see any reason for it, there can't be any. Well, that doesn't lead you anywhere. That just leaves you to become a miserable and bitter person. Fortunately, Christianity's approach is neither, as I've discussed. So finally, what should we do when troubles come our way? And as they have, I'm sure, in your lives. Well, I'll give three practical answers and one dynamic one. First practical one is humility. When it says in today's text, "Receive hardships as paideia," or pediatrics, that means you should receive them like a child. Now, like a child, I don't mean being childish, but it's about an attitude. Like a child. And therefore, the most important thing to say when troubles come your way is, if I'm a child of God, remember that children, earthly children, can never understand the discipline of a parent, even when it's good. And I'm sure you as parents have seen this and experienced this. Maybe you had lousy parents, I don't know. But I'm sure you all know, those of you who are parents know this, that even when you do good parenting and you're laying down consequences, it's always for the child way too much and way too long. Isn't it? They always say, "Oh, that's unfair." That's always the reaction. They can never understand the reasons behind the consequences. And oftentimes it'll take 20 years before the child gets it. "Oh, I remember why you did that." You see, you and I are children compared to God. You know, despair is always an act of ignorance. The only way you can be in despair is because you are at least you think you are, absolutely sure there is nothing good that can come out of your suffering and trouble. If that's what you think, you'll inevitably be led to despair. So first of all, humility. Receive your situation as children. Second, obedience. The word endures is the Greek word waupomeno. I'm not sure if I said it right, but anyways. Which means stand firm or do not budge. What almost everybody does, this is something I really struggle with. I got to really work on this one. What almost everybody does instinctively in the midst of suffering is retreat from normal things that are the right thing to be doing. So we may retreat from prayer. We may retreat from engaging and helping other people as we normally do. We may retreat from worshiping, just carrying on with our day-to-day tasks. Or at the very least, we stop eating or we don't eat right. Well, that is the worst possible thing to do. John Owen, a man who lived in the 17th century and did a lot of sailing, says this. When a storm and a wind come up, go to the wheel and hold the wheel and rudder steady. And when the storm is over, you will have actually gotten to your destiny faster. But if you go beneath deck and just let the wheel go wherever it may go, you'll never get to your destination. When storms come up, it will either make you far better than you've ever been or far worse than you've ever been. The key, when we're faced with troubles or tribulations or whatever, is to hold on to the rudder, hold on to the wheel. The key is to do the right thing and then to do the next thing, despite the suffering. Don't think about what are you going to do even at the end of the day or tomorrow? But just take one step at a time. Obedience. When you're suffering, do the right thing and then do the next thing. It's not all you have to do, but it's critical. So you have humility, you have obedience. Third, evaluation. It says in verse 2, remove everything that hinders and sin that easily entangles. Gym clothes can be great, right? Gym clothes can be great. They are much more comfortable than wearing suits, dresses, and high-heeled shoes, right? But the good thing about dress clothes is that they hide what you really look like, right? But when you go to the gym and put on your gym clothes and you look in the mirror, guess what? Nothing's hidden. Nothing's hidden. You can see what you really look like. Unless I'm like Grant, I'm going to look very different. I just lost my place. Oh, there you are. Likewise, suffering in life can be like wearing your gym clothes. It can bring out the worst in you. It can bring out your fears, your cowardice, your pride, your self-centeredness. And the most important thing you can do when suffering comes your way is to say, Lord, what do you want me to work on? What do you want me to work on? Dietrich Bonhoeffer said, beware in times of suffering. That is when sin can really take root in us. That is when kind of the negative aspects of our character really bubble up. And yes, we want to be sympathetic with the sick and the needy. Of course we do. But it's also an opportunity to turn to the Lord and say, hey, what do you want to work on? What do you want to change? Lastly, the most important is the dynamic. All of this is technique, and it's not going to work on its own. I've just given you the engine. So here's the gas. What's the gas? Well, the gas, of course, as you know, is Jesus. You need to fix your eyes on him, as it says in verse 2. Look to Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of your faith, who for the sake of the joy that was set before him endured the cross and has taken his seat at the right hand of the throne of God. But not only fix your eyes on Jesus, also fix your eyes with Jesus. What did Jesus do? Well, as you know, he suffered. This is the leg up that Christianity has on any other religion or philosophy of life. If you're a secularist, there are lots of advantages of being a secularist. But suffering isn't one of them. For the secularist, suffering inevitably is meaningless. It just happens. There's no answer to it. There's no purpose to it. And if you can't avoid it, you just don't know how to deal with it. Other religions believe in God, but their God did not suffer. Only our God suffered for us. Question, why are we running the race? Well, for the joy that's set before us. What is that joy? Well, we need to have, again, a big enough theory of life so the joy set before us can't just be, surely can't just be happiness and comfort in this life. The joy set before us is getting the greatness and glory of God into our souls, getting a taste of what we're eventually going to be fully become in the last days in our resurrection. Okay, that's what that joy is. Another question, which is really important. What was Jesus' joy? Why did Jesus run the race? Was it to get the glory of God? He had the glory of God. He didn't need to get it. Was it to get holiness? He had all the holiness. Why would Jesus come to earth and get in the race? Well, as far as I know, there's only one answer, and you find it in, well, I find it elsewhere, but particularly in the book of Isaiah, where he talks about the suffering servant. It says, the results of his suffering, as Jesus, he shall see and be satisfied. What are the results of his suffering? What is the only thing the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit did not have in heaven? What is the only thing? You. Right? It's you. You are the only thing. And that means in Jesus' suffering, he was seeking you. And now Jesus is saying to you, in your suffering, seek me. Here's what Jesus is saying to you. In my suffering, I lost my Father. But in your suffering, you'll get the Father. I lost God so you can have God. I lost everything in my suffering so you can get everything in your suffering. That's the gas. That's the gas that will enable you to face, they'll give you a bigger picture of reality and what it's all about, and enable you to face your trials and tribulations. Amen.